want numbers, and they want them right away.
Can you just briefly summarize the case of Officer Adrian Schoolcraft, what happened to him?
Adrian Schoolcraft, almost at the same time that I spoke up, he did the same thing. He did some recordings. I was not aware. I don't know him. And one day, I don't know the whole full story, they went to his house and they put him in a psych ward and did not even notify his family that he was in a psych ward for 3 days.
So he couldn't reach his father.
He couldn't reach his father. He couldn't do anything. And they still justifying everything. And those people that did that against him, there's no accountability. Nothing happens to them.
And is Schoolcraft officer today?
No, he left. He left.
Are you concerned about continuing to speak out, even after your year is suspended with pay, you're back on the force?
I'm not giving up. Nobody's speaking for us. I started talking against Stop and Frisk when nobody was involved. Absolutely nobody.
That was New York police officer Adil Polanco. He was suspended with pay for more than 3 years after he began speaking out against the New York Police Department's stop and frisk procedures. He testified in the recent stop and frisk trial here in New York. He's now back as an active duty police officer, though on modified assignment. To get a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Felser, Sarah Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gezder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:02. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with host Lisa Loving. Today we have representatives from the Office of Equity and Human Rights of the City of Portland in to talk about recognizing and overcoming barriers to equal opportunity in our diverse community of Portland.
Hi, this is Per Fogring, host of Fight the Empire. Lester Brown grew up on a farm in New Jersey, and now he writes about the planet's ability to feed all of its people. 50 years ago, he wrote a book called Man, Land, and Food. Then he went on to found the World Watch Institute and the Earth Policy Institute. Thursday, Lester Brown will be my guest on an hour-long special starting at 9 a.m. That's Thursday, November 7th. At 9 a.m., a conversation with Lester Brown on KBOO, your radio station.
The KBOO Foundation, licensee of non-commercial FM radio station KBOO 90.7, Portland, Oregon, gives notice that on October 29, 2013, an application, FCC Form 315, for consent to transfer control of the license from the old board to the new board of directors was filed with the Federal Communications Commission. Officers and directors of the old board were Paula Small, Michael Papadopoulos, Hadrian Machiche, S.W. Conser, Mark Brown, Lynn Mollick, Lisa Loving, Jeff Kippelman, John Mackey, Damon Isaiah Turner, Matthew Bristow, and Rabia Yeaman. Officers and directors of the new board are Matthew Bristow, Adine Rogovin, Mark Sherman, Susan Bartlett, Joe Uris, Jennifer Davis, Michael Wells, Lynn Mollick, S.W. Conser, Michael Papadopoulos, Timothy Welp, and Jeff Kippelman. A copy of the application and related materials are available for public inspection at KBOO's main studio at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, between the hours of 9 a.m. and 5 p.m., Monday through Friday.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
It is 8.06 a.m. and you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving, and today, Portland's Mutual Assistance Associations and our city's civic culture. Have you ever sat around and wondered how people from our newcomer communities show up in Portland and figure out how to plug into the city? Have you ever wondered that? Today, we're going to learn how that happens, and maybe, listeners, you'll learn how you can support that or participate in it. So we're joined here in the circle, this very crowded Studio 2 this morning. We're joined by Renaud Catalani, New Portlander Programs City Office of Equity and Human Rights. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Lisa.
We're also here with Jime Dogo, Portland African Community Elder and IRCO Africa House Manager.
Thank you, Lisa.
We're with Chabi Kwerala, Orican Bhutanese Community Organization.
Thank you, Lisa.
Dr. Bahir Bhuti, Iraqi Society of Oregon.
Thank you.
And Alberto Moreno from the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. Yay!
Good morning, everyone.
Thank you guys for being here. This is a big show. This is a big ship we're launching here because a lot of times we're looking at some small slice of an issue that people can get involved in. But now we're bringing, I want to say, four or five communities into this room so that people can learn about the part of Portland that they don't see. So, Renaud, Mr. Catalani, can you talk a little bit about mutual assistance associations? It's a thing. It's a federal category of, talk about it. What does it mean?
It's a thing. We are a thing. Thank you, Lisa, for having us on the air, and KBOO, of course, for welcoming us on your airwaves. Mutual assistance associations sounds very big, and in fact it is, but actually it's really rather simple, and it's rather mechanically straightforward. And I would let the fellas around the table explain more of how things get done. How do new families get integrated into the life of our lovely city? I just want to say as a kickoff that Portland is now 1 in 5 foreign-born. This shouldn't shock people. It's just that now we have the data to support what we already know. This is Portland. The port part should be emphasized. Also, about half of those kids in school are ethnic minority children. This is not scary news. This is really a wonderful opportunity as we become a very cosmopolitan place to live, where our business gets bigger and broader, and where, of course, the social and cultural capital that our folks bring in contributes so much and will be contributing so much more to the ethos and aesthetic of our city. With that, let me turn it back to you again, Lisa, and get these hands-on sort of caretaker, big uncles, elders, and activists participating.
Big uncles. So when people do arrive, you know, a lot of times when we look at our progressive community, we're tied into the dreamers, the dreamer generation, people that we just are more familiar with the issues and situations of people who maybe don't have all their papers, are not totally documented. Those are the issues that we just see the most noise around in the community, and they are hugely important. Here we have communities of people who have come here through the system, and still, I mean, people still, even though maybe the government does not, even though they're here under the auspices with all their paperwork intact to the degree that that's possible, still there's a lot of work in bringing people in and plugging them in to our communities. And so I wanted to kind of go around the room and just ask our guests a little bit of what you guys do. Now, when we're talking about mutual assistance associations, you guys are not paid to help people, right? You're leaders in your community, and you reach out and you help people. It's not like a badge and a clock in. It's, you understand what I'm saying? It's not a job that you're paid to do. It's what people do in our own communities for ourselves. So I wanted to start with Chabi Kerala, Oregon Bhutanese Community Organization. Mr. Kerala, talk about what you do within this position, this situation, Mutual Assistance Association.
We are the newest community here in Portland. So when our community come here, they have a big dream. They have a lot of dreams to fulfill. But when they are here, they have a lot of problem because of cultural barrier. They cannot do anything by themselves. So we have to help them at any time, like when the emergency arises, starting from like making their appointments for emergency situation, like going to SSI appointment, going to medical appointment, and many other. So even at midnight, when something wrong goes, some accidents or some serious things happens in their family, we have to be there at any time. So that way we go and help them.
Someone will text you at midnight and say, we need your help here at Emmanuel. Come, please.
They call us because they have our numbers.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to Jime Dogo. Where are you from originally?
Jime Dogo, originally from Chad, Central Africa.
Okay. Talk a little bit about the IRCO Africa House and the work that you do with your community of people that you support.
IRCO Africa House is a one-stop service center that provides an array of service, culturally specific service to African community. Our role is to galvanize, advocate for support for African refugee resettlement and also to provide culturally specific services. We opened our door in 2006 because so many African refugees are coming and they're struggling to navigate the system here. So we decide to open Africa House, work to empower our community who are coming here. Most of those refugees are coming from rural area with zero urban living experience. So they need help to navigate the system, to just go to a hospital, come to a classroom, communicate with the school. So because of the language barrier, they need extra help. And some of the family who are coming here, they spent so many years in refugee camp. So they're completely disconnected with governmental services or with urban living experience. They came here with post-traumatic disorder. They have a lot of issues that they bring here with them. So they need extra help for somebody to help them so that they can help themselves and help their family. We have several African coming here, especially for the last fiscal year. We have about 252 individuals that came to Portland, Oregon. So all those individuals, when they come here, they have their personal need, individual need, family need, and somebody has to help them navigate the system, connect them with culturally specific services, store, and also just with their ethnic background, you know, faith and community-based organization. So in general, our work is to galvanize and bring the support for resettlement of those refugees and how they can, you know, be the citizen of tomorrow.
IRCO is Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization. I'm sure a lot of listeners knew that already. IRCO actually serves a lot of different communities. We need to bring more people from IRCO on the air. You guys do a lot.
Thank you.
So now let's go to Alberto Moreno, Oregon Latino Health Coalition. Alberto, so when we're talking about the work that you big uncles do with mutual assistance associations, what I'm really interested in, and if you could talk about that a little bit more, is like how structured is it? So as you are, I mean, as we're talking about this, is the Oregon Latino Health Coalition a mutual assistance association, or are we talking about something that you do? Talk about a little bit more, like flesh it out for us a little, if you could.
Thank you. We're a little bit different than our friends here, our brothers here, in that there are 452,000 Latinos now in the state. It is a sizable population, which makes meaningful contributions to the state economy. We have purchasing power over $7 billion. The migrant and seasonal farm workers, who number 160,000 in the state, contribute over $4.3 billion to our economy each and every single year. We recognize, as you've heard from Jimmy, that there are acculturation issues, that there are integration issues that our communities face. The idea of speaking language, this language, is a multi-generational process. It takes more than one generation for us to become fluent, to become conversant in a very unique language and a very unique system. The Oregon Latino Health Coalition is specifically focused on helping to redress significant policy gaps that exist for this community. So we cannot be sated anymore as a community with symbolic action. We understand that if we're going to have real, meaningful change, that it needs to be informed by our state laws, by our state policies, and that is the specific jurisdiction of this organization. We want to change state law to ensure, for example, that all women have access to prenatal care, to ensure that all of our children have the medical care that they need. We want to make sure that all of our communities have access to economic opportunity, that we have access to jobs, that we have the same opportunity to participate civically, to participate in this economy. So as Jimmy said, so that we can continue to be the vibrant Oregon that we all intend for our state.
Mm. Amazing. Fabulous. And now let's go to Dr. Bahir Bhutti, Iraqi Society of Oregon. Sir, talk about your work. What do you do with your Mutual Assistant Association work?
Well, thank you very much, Lisa. And I have to say, like, it's not just the Iraqi Society of Oregon that I founded in 2008. I came to America in 2007, so now I'm working also with other associations and actual organizations, Center for Intercultural Organizing, Arab American Culture Center of Oregon, Colored Pencils Art and Culture, and my job is case manager for refugees in the Lutheran Community Service. So all these agencies, some of them are funded, some are not, mostly work trying to resettle what we like to call ourselves as newcomers to America. The refugees, it's unlike, like Alberto said, it's unlike the case of the immigrants. Here we have people small in size, but with a very large humanitarian problems. We are forced to leave our countries. So we'll come here with, you can imagine a stranger coming, no language, no understanding of the culture, and it's like landing on the moon. It's totally different from an American or European visiting Africa or South or East Asia, for example, Asia. It's a person will come here, no language, no cultural understanding. It's totally strange situation for him. We work on whether through federally funded programs to resettle refugees, like I do as a case manager in the Lutheran, and the need for that, we do the housing, providing transportation to appointments when we need in the beginning. But then when a person has a colic pain and has a headache at midnight, he needs someone. And that's when they will call us. And that's not the paid job in any way. He will need people to navigate the system, help him navigate the system. We, the mentality of research, we don't have this kind of mentality. So you come with shock, trauma, psychological trauma due to violence that we suffered. So you don't have the ability to understand how to help yourself and as a beginning until we get acculturated. So this is a long path that we help our people to do. We help each other, and we need the help of the old comers. You know, American, it's the American dream, as Chappie said, but and regardless of the economy, the dream can still be there if the old comers, the Americans, help our people by embracing them, by welcoming to cross this way until we get acculturated and all healed, right, and acculturated. Thank you.
Thank you. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio. We're talking about Portland's Mutual Assistance Associations and our city's civic culture. We're here with Renaud Catalani. He works for the city of Portland to help figure out how people fit together. We're also here with Jime Dogo from IRCO Africa House, Chabi Kerala from the Oregon Bhutanese Community Organization, Dr. Bahir Bhutti, who you just heard, from Iraqi Society of Oregon and Lutheran Family Services. They do a lot. And Alberto Moreno of the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. There's so many questions that I have for our wonderful guests, but we do have a caller. Let's go to the phone lines. We have Joanne. Joanne, what do you think?
Well, I'm mad at myself, first of all, but that's my problem. Last week, I told Joanne on her program that I wasn't going to call in to Cable anymore out of respect and memory of the people our country is killing with drones. But being a weak human being and just being mad ongoing about a lot of real problems, I'm calling in today. So here goes. Yeah, even though I haven't been listening, well, anyway, who cares? In your conversations and thinking about your topic today or whatever, where does your thinking and your talking going in regards to impose a gentrification and impose elitism and impose classism in our lives forever? Anyway, I'll get off and listen.
All right. Joanne, I love it when you call. And you always put really hot, bubbling pots on the table, and I really appreciate that. And so Joanne, she's kind of the conscience of this show, in my opinion. She calls up and asks questions that are inconvenient. And what I kind of hear her saying is, what I hear Joanne asking is, what do you think about some of the financial, the economic struggles that your communities are going through? And as you look at coverage, maybe in Portland, of how communities get shoved around, what we call gentrification, communities that get sort of segregated into certain parts of, you know what, Joanne, we talk about gentrification anymore. In my mind, I'm thinking of it as segregation because that's kind of, that's what it looks like to me. So if that's okay, I would like to go around the table and ask you guys, Joanne's asking about the economics of it, like elitism, like how do you deal with all the people that are maybe watching you if you go shopping in Macy's, just to take one example. How do you deal with fitting in? What are some of the bigger issues? And I hope that's what you're asking, Joanne. She also asked about drone attacks, and you guys have all now talked about the post-traumatic stress that people have. People coming from different parts of the world who have had to deal with violence. And that's a big, tough issue. I know our listeners would love to support people in that position too. I don't have any idea how that could happen. But I want to start with Mr. Kerala from the Oregon Bhutanese Community Organization. Sir, so in your community of people, when you are, we have newcomers, we have families and individuals moving in, what are some of the biggest struggles that people have in fitting in? Is it economics? Is it like getting stuck living in some place that's far away from the city center? What are some of the bigger issues that people have a hard time dealing with, besides, say, for example, the language barrier?
we have a lot of issues, like navigating the system in U.S., how to deal with appointments, transportation. That is also a big challenge because they are very new here. They are here only for few months to like 3-4 years. So our community has been resettling here since 2008. So they have major issues of like mental problems, mental health issues, and many other barriers and challenges, employment issues, because when they go for employment, they need recent verifiable employment history, which they do not have. So it is very hard for them at the beginning to find a job.
And when we're talking about Bhutan, we're talking about Bhutanese refugees. We are talking about people who maybe had the opportunity to come here, as you said, from a camp, like living in a camp. I mean, yes. It's hard to, you know, we could talk about the Occupy and Occupy Portland. It's not the same thing at all. I love and respect all the people. You know, it's going to be the 2-year anniversary of the city destroying the Occupy camp. But we're going to have someone on the air, I believe, next week talking about that. But this is, it's a different situation. So thank you. Mr. Dogo, can you talk about it? Like the obstacles that your community members face. You can bring that microphone closer to you. It's totally fine. This is live radio on KBOO in beautiful Cascadia in the Pacific Northwest. But the issues that you're really struggling, grappling with to help your people with.
When the refugee come here in Portland, they come here with zero economic asset. Therefore, they have a very limited resources. And most of the time, they are resettled in a neighborhood, a poor neighborhood with limited resources, infected with gang issues, all kind of urban issues. And those refugees already come here with post-traumatic disorder. They witness atrocity where they came from. And then they end up in those neighborhood. And they come here with their children. So their children start, you know, getting involved in gang issue on all the urban issue that those refugees don't know about it. Where they came from, they know about the warlord, they know about rebels and all those, but they don't understand what's gang in the middle of the city. So all those issues that they're facing, the children that are facing, on top of language barrier and also unemployment. On top of this, there is lack of culturally specific mental health services to help those refugees who been through a lot, atrocity, so that they can help themselves. Some of them are coming from a culture where nobody talks about mental health. Mental health is pretty much a taboo, it's a craziness. If you have a mental problem, you are crazy. But now it's our job to educate them that mental health is just like malaria, that we have it back home and there is a help for it. Housing is the most important issue when refugee comes here. So even though they move from their country to a second country, now to a third country, they start moving from one county to another county looking for affordable housing, low-income housing.
Wow.
And then okay. It affects their children's education. Sometimes they move in the middle of a school year.
Because they have to. If you get a housing opportunity, you cannot pass it up.
Exactly. So in one school year, you have family moving 2-3 times that affect the children's education. And as a result, we have a low education attainment. We have kids don't understand because they've been changing school and teacher and friends, and all those affect, you know, children's success at school. Health problem. Refugee come here, they don't understand why they go to hospital, and then they have a lot of specialists. They came from a place where you have a one doctor maybe for the rest of your life, as long as you go to the hospital. This is only the one doctor you see. So when they come here, you have a heart specialist and this specialist and this. So they're completely confused why they keep changing doctor on me. And also, they're scared of American healthcare system. Because if I go
scared of the American healthcare system, they're not alone. There's plenty of people
exactly.
in America that are scared of that thing. It's thrown more people into bankruptcy than... Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead. That's what you were saying.
So for them, going to hospital going to result in surgery and in death and all this. So all kind of trauma that they have. On top of that, policing. They bring with them bad experience from their home country with their police in their home country. So when they see our police here, they think it's the same police back home. So we work with a different police precinct to educate those families that the police here is not the same as the police back home. So we have police coming to our community, educating the community, educating family, working with our children. We have other law enforcement coming to the community and helping us. We have a FBI, we have a police bureau, we have all other law enforcement. We have lawyers to come just to educate people on, you know, what are the role of the police here and what are the role of civilian or the citizen, how they can work together for the greatest good of the community.
And I want to follow up on that. One of the other issues that I know is a few years ago, I interviewed some people with the African Women's Coalition, who I think were with Lutheran Family Services at the time. And they were doing the first ever, I want to say it was a health survey of the African communities, because there's not just one community involved. That's part of the problem that we have here. I'm just going to say I'm a middle-aged white lady perspective, that institution who sees all black people as being the same. And one of the things that the African Women's Coalition talked about was that they were struggling to drill down in, as Polo was talking about, the schools, in the Portland Public Schools. They just did a survey of all African-American students, and they included all the black students in there, and it literally had not occurred to the school district that students who were coming as immigrants or refugees from the African continent or parts of South America, for that matter, they didn't have the same issues as the African American students. They literally had different needs. They had language barriers. And it's like it was so revolutionary for the women from the African Women's Coalition to just stand up and say, why are you lumping these people together? And they approached the schools and tried to get the schools to tell them how many African students there were. schools had no idea. That didn't even occur to them to ask. So that's part of what we're talking about, just that basic level of even the people in the wider community understanding what's going on is amazing. So now let's go to, I wanted to go to Mr. Moreno to talk about that. What are, as you heard Joanne say, you know, and Joanne, like I said, she's kind of the conscience of the show. She's saying, what about gentrification? What about elitism? How does it hit your community?
It's important to talk about why we're here, how we ended up here. We have been displaced from our communities. We have been displaced from our countries as a result of violence, as a result of wars, as a result of our foreign policies. And so there is displacement through violence. There's economic displacement, so that when we come here, and we are displaced from near East Portland to far East Portland, it is all too familiar for us. We know that we will be shed out to the borders of this city where there are less resources, where the communities are not safe, where our housing is substandard, because that's all we can afford. We have to understand that this is a result of economic and social policy, that it is not accidental, that when we choose to pay our farm workers less than $10,000 a year, that limits their options, that limits their mobility, both economic, both socially, both educationally. People ask all the time, why won't those people simply learn English? And I want to answer that for us. It's because if you get paid less than $10,000 a year, you have to work 2-3 jobs. And then you have to come home and do laundry for your children. You have to cook for them. And so at 9 p.m., at 10 p.m., when your work is finally all done, how can you have the energy to take a class if someone was offering an English class at 10 p.m. So many of our questions are uninformed. But if they are informed, they're informed by our privilege. We don't have the same opportunity to shop at these fancy stores like Whole Foods. We are priced out of them. We can't even go into them because we need to feed families of 5 and 7 and 10, and we can't do that in Whole Foods. It doesn't exist for us. It's not part of our reality. And so we do shop at Safeway. We shop at Costco because we have to make our dollar go as far as it can. And so I think we have to be aware how our foreign policy, how our economic policies are the root causes of our being here.
All right. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio. We are going around the room. We are talking about Portland's mutual assistance associations and our city's civic culture. And now let's give the talking stick to Dr. Bhuti, Iraqi Society of Oregon. What are some of the issues? I feel like when we're talking about the Iraqi society, Iraqi community, that there's something especially horribly racist about our mainstream society in the United States when it comes to people coming from specifically the Middle Eastern war zones. I don't want that to be true, but I wonder if that is true. Talk a little bit about some of the extra issues that you're dealing with your community.
I think you're referring to the Islamophobia in particular, of course, and this is this is part of the general xenophobia, let's say, the fear of strangers that some people have here. And sometimes it can be understandable in the sense that every human being on earth will be afraid of a new thing, of a stranger. But then once you try to expand your vision to understand, like I have seen people who ask, like, why our government bring refugees? When we have economic problems. Okay, it's your responsibility when you say this to understand that
America is an international power, so there are international responsibilities. So that's how refugees come. And when refugees come, we do contribute to the economy in this country. We can start by having the resettlement process by using resources, but then eventually this will be a labor power, this will be professionals who will contribute back to the country, be part of the economical cycle. And there are statistics about that can prove how much refugees are contributing, like Alberto just said, it's a $7 billion thing, for example, dollars. So this is one part of the problems that we can face by people here. There's this second part of people who are willing to help, actually. But then it will need, like, for example, if we need to learn, one of the main, very main obstacles is the language barrier. People come, they don't have the English language, it needs time to learn, and then you cannot have a job if you do not have this language thing, which delays the process. So, and the resources that are available, and let me just take here a cut, like when we talk about resources, we are talking about, for example, family of four people will come with, will receive rental assistance, cash assistance, $620. $620. There is no apartment at this time that costs this much, because it has to be two bedrooms. And if you can find someone with
$600... That's about half as much, as you would get. I'm saying I'm seeing some really cheap apartments for $1,100, but $620, that's not...
Oh, no, we don't even... We cannot, by law, think of higher rates, you know, because, like, how are you going to pay for it? There are all these limitations anyway, and if you find a cheap one, it's a low standard. But anyway, you can see how resources are going. But anyway, if you are looking to... trying to let the guy be self-sufficient and start a job, you need the English language. Again, resources for ESL are limited, and we'll need volunteers to do that, because, for example, we cannot have, and this is the psychological, psychosocial part of it, like a woman, for example, from the Middle East, she will not leave the house and leave her children with either alone or with strangers, let's say. This is not in our cultural understanding of things. So it needs people who can, and there are the good-hearted people who wants to volunteer to do things for these. It's a part of the sharing concept of this country. So when we have these volunteers, the problem with these volunteers is that they are missing the part of the cultural humility. They want to impose their own, let's say, cultural standards on the family. Otherwise, they will disconnect. And so it's a whole dynamic process. It's an ongoing process that needs a lot of efforts. And thank you for you, for KBO, to be part of this process, to help in acculturation and mutual and building mutual understanding. Actually, it's not just us doing the mutual assistance. We need mutual understanding between all the people living in this part of the world.
All right. Thank you. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio. The Magical Engineering Pixie just ran in a note, and I just want to say, this is a digital medium, but he writes it on a tiny, like a candy bar wrapper with a pencil, and he runs it in here, which I think is awesome. So the Magical Engineering Pixie says, how do other cities handle integrating immigrant and refugee communities? Does Portland do it well? Are there lessons we should be learning from other places, like, say, for example, Minneapolis, St. Paul, says the Engineering Pixie. It could have very well been the studio dog that wrote this. But how do... I'd like to go back around the circle. I think that's a great question. And I would tack something onto it as well. How do other cities handle integrating immigrants? And is there something that you need that you're not getting that maybe our listeners could help you with? I know, listeners, y'all are out there listening. I know you want to help because I know you. So let's go around the circle. What do you think of how other cities handle it? Do you think we could do better? And what do you really need?
According to the Bhutanese community organization, we have a community organization in New Hampshire, Manchester. The executive of that association is Tika Acharya. So he has organized that organization in 2008, and they are getting a lot of support from the states and from the city, and they have their own like ESL classes, citizenship classes. And also they help all the communities at any time they require, and they are paid. I don't know how they receive from the city, but they are getting the, like they are funded by the city and the state. And we are also doing similar type of program, but this is all totally volunteer. Like we are helping our community by providing ESL classes and also citizenship classes. But it is totally volunteer, and there are a lot of volunteers doing it from America, from our community, and from other, and it is not funded. So I think that is a good example that in New Hampshire, I think they are funded by some state and also by the city. That is how they are progressing, and they're doing good.
All right. You know, just a side note, I got my property tax note. I got my property tax bill a few weeks ago. My head snapped off. I freaked out looking at all the stuff that was tacked onto my property taxes, including more than $500 just for the police and firefighters' disability and retirement fund. And it does make me wonder sometimes what we pay for, how we end up paying for it is a fascinating thing. So let me just follow up, though, and say, what do you wish you had? So what I kind of hear you saying is you wish that you had the resources to pay people from your community to teach the language piece and to do some of the citizenship. Is there anything else? What do you really wish you had?
Yes, Lisa, that is one of our biggest dreams, that if they are funded and they can be helped, because most of these people, our community, need a language here to survive and to fulfill their dream. And other thing is, like, if they can navigate the system here easily, then I think it will be better for them in future.
Hmm. The system, you mean like just the political system, the social system?
Social system, health system, the system, every system here. It's so difficult for them. It is very different from our place. So,
do you get to vote? Do you get to vote? I'm asking a really ignorant question right now. Do you get to vote?
Not yet, because okay. I'm not the citizen.
So
still.
When people, you get your citizenship thing and then people can vote. I'm just thinking out loud, Democratic Party, what are you doing? Anyway, Jimmy Dogo, can you talk a little bit about, do you see perhaps other cities that do integrating immigrants and refugees better than Portland? Are there things Portland could do better, and what do you really wish you had?
So far, Portland is doing its best to integrate refugees and immigrants who are coming, but we want to see more. We want to see integration like in Minneapolis, where yesterday in the history, you know, of America, a Somali former refugee was elected Minneapolis city council member.
What?
It was a big celebration on the news, and I was watching this all night. So we need to see more of those kind of things happening here. With the participation of the coalition of community of color that include the African, the African American, the Native American, the Latino, the Asian, and also the Slavic, six different community, the coalition is working hard, you know, to work with the city, work with the decision maker to do more for the minorities. We want to see also how we can reduce disparity between us, community of coalition of color, immigrant and refugees, and the mainstream community. We want to see foreign credential recognized. One of the reasons that refugee community are the poorest communities because people come here with
doctors, lawyers, yeah, plumbers, all kinds of things. Yeah,
yeah. But those are not credential are not recognized here. Therefore, they end up doing minimum pay job while they have all those degrees. So we want Portland to make an effort to help those refugees recognize their credentials so that we can reduce the poverty level, we can reduce those disparities. For instance, in the African community, if you see the report that we published, the African community report we published last month, the child poverty rate is above 67%, while at the same time, the African community is the highest educated community. So, they're underemployed, they're the poor, they're underserved. So we need more of those, more of culturally specific and linguistic services to help those people navigate the system, to help those people, you know, go back to school, to help those people so that they can get recertified, so that they can get better job in order to help their family. Because they've been to school either in Europe, in Russia, in Africa, in Asia. But when they come here, all, some of them have even a degree from Canada here, but those degrees are not recognized here. And for somebody that is 6 years old, 7 years old, work all their life for like 30, 40 years, and you tell them their degree is not recognized, they have to go back to the very start. It's really hard. So we are advocating to see those things happen. We are advocating for all the decision makers, for the city, for the county, for the state, to hire more of representative of community of color to serve their people, to be there, to be inclusive, to be part of the system, to be part of the decision making, to be part of the government. We want to see a real integration, real diversity at the level of the personnel, of the decision maker, and at all level that we want to participate. We are part of it. We are not going back. We, some of us are citizens. We vote. So we are contributing to the economy, to the politics, to everything that's happening here. So we want to be part of it, and we need help from everybody. And also we need that those degrees should be taken into consideration with a system like in Canada, where they have a foreign degree recertification. If Canada is doing this to integrate, you know, foreign professional, why United States is not doing it? Because it's going to be very helpful. We have a lot of teachers, we have a lot of doctors that will be a liaison between the community and the school, a liaison between the health institution and the different community that are coming to Poland. Poland will continue receiving refugees from all over the world. And we have to start working on integrating people, on recognizing those degrees, and they will do a good job in helping for the economy of the region. Thank you.
It's so interesting about that issue of the recertification of professional credentials for immigrants and refugees, because my kids, when they were middle school students, they made friends with the janitor at their school. And then one day they said, oh my God, he's a surgeon, but he's from Cuba, and now he's scrubbing floors. And I feel as though just this past year, I heard someone in local government talking about there is no process for recertification at all. It's like, again, we're looking at this complete blind spot, like just a staggering blind spot, if you don't mind my saying so, racist blind spot, where anyone that's not trained in the United States must not be as good as anyone that's trained in the United States. If people in this country knew how many doctors in America were trained in Grenada, you'd freak out. I'm just saying that, okay? I'm not just saying that. It's true. But anyway, it's like I feel so that's a racist thing when we don't even value these processes, the doctors, the lawyers. You know, certain things are maybe location specific, such as law, but a lot of things, especially medical specialties, these recertification programs are just a basic thing. It to me, there's this stereotype of immigrants as being like children in this country. Mm-hmm. It's like the layers of racism and privilege that we have here are staggering. And Mr. Dogo, I just pulled up this story. It freaks me out. The Star Tribune, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, first Somali elected to Minneapolis City Council. This is awesome. Abdi Warsame made history Tuesday by becoming the highest elected Somali in the country, winning a seat on the city council in a landslide. Two decades after a wave of East Africans arrived in Minneapolis to escape civil war, they emerged as a political force to elect one of their own for the first time to City Hall, jumping out of their seats at a Cedar Riverside Theater to cheer, clap, and embrace one another as Warsame took the stage. Dude, but the irony is that that's kind of our ideal of what the United States is, the melting pot thing. We love the melting pot thing. We can't deal with the melting pot thing. Anyway, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives, host Linda Olson Osterlund interviews Elliot Adams, former soldier and past president of National Veterans for Peace, about the Close Gitmo campaign and hunger strikes in solidarity with detainees. Did I just say something about Cuba? At 9:30, guest filmmaker Mark Kitchell talks about his film A Fierce Green Fire, The Battle for a Living Planet, an exploration of the environmental movement and grassroots activism spanning 50 years from conservation to climate change. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoint's Fukushima, at a critical moment. As pro-nuke scientists still call nuclear power the real answer to the future's clean energy needs. Also, the fight to keep Edward Snowden free in the face of his courageous act of whistleblowing on America's massive spy network. And at 11, The Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. We're live in Studio 2 with, an amazing group of guys. We are here with Renaud Catalani. He works as the New Portlander with the New Portlander programs at the City Office of Equity and Human Rights. We're also here with Jimé Dogo. You just heard him, Portland African Community Elder and IRCO Africa House Manager. Also, Chabi Kerala, Oregon Bhutanese Community Organization. We're also here with Alberto Moreno of the Oregon Latino Health Coalition and Dr. Bahir Bhuti, Iraqi Society of Oregon. And I just got passed a note that said that Dr. Bahir Bhuti is a psychiatrist, and you're not, because of this lack of certification, you're not able to practice here. Is that true?
Well, it's not an issue of lack of recertification. Trying to recertify, to get recertification as a medical practitioner, physician here, it's a very long process. And when I came to the country, I needed the work. I needed to work to finance my family. So I didn't have this time and energy to go to this kind of... it's the hardest in the world, by the way, this medical recertification. USMLE thing. The good news is my wife is doing it, so I think we'll get along in a few years.
We don't do so well with any of our kids going to college because we tack these gigantic debts.
I had this experience. I worked, fortunately, within the mental health field. It was called the Qualified Mental Health Associate, and I ended up cleaning in shelters. I mean, doing cleaning jobs. So we do what we have to do to get the chance to resettle here in this country. So, I mean, this is the good part. We are not that passive, believe me. And I need to link it to this issue of that, what are we doing in Portland? There is this, we have the Center for Intercultural Organizing. We are members in a National Alliance for Social Justice. I can tell you we are the only, almost the only organization that represents the newcomers from Africa, Middle East, Central or South Asia, and Portland is lucky to have this kind of, because you were talking about like what the Democratic Party is doing. Thank you. I mean, for everyone, for the progressive people, but don't do it for us. Help us do it for ourselves. This is what we are trying to do. So we are working on it, and you can see our group here with you. I think this is an indication that we can do something.
And I wanted to take a moment and bring that question to Alberto Moreno. What do you think that other cities or other places do the integration of communities better than we do? Are there certain lessons we could be bringing from someone else? And what do you need in your work?
It's a great question. I think it's a timely question. Other cities like Chicago, Minneapolis, you've heard, do a fairly good job of integrating our immigrant brothers and sisters. Portland, thanks to the work of Polo and thanks to the work of others here in this room, is trying to do better. But to address your question, we still need some basic things. Cities like Chicago have a Centro Latino, Latino Center. Here, while we're the largest minority in the state, in the city certainly, the city of Portland still doesn't have a Latino center, a Casa Latina, where our communities can go and feel safe and ask questions and take English classes and find out about services, find out how they can volunteer, how they can contribute, where to get daycare services. So we need a Casa Latina. We need a safe haven. We also have an issue with day laborers. These are the folks that our nice white brothers and sisters hire as they're driving down Martin Luther King to do their landscaping for a day, to help them with construction jobs, to help them do some of the cleaning. These folks are often taken advantage of. They are often taken to very remote work sites where their labor, their hand labor, their shoulders are put to work. And then at the end of the day, they're actually not paid. And they're abandoned in these remote rural places without any way of getting home. The Day Labor Center was started not long ago here in the city to help with some of those abuse issues. But now we need our mayor to really step up and secure funding for that center. We need him to keep his campaign promise of actually allocating a permanent property, a permanent location for this vital workforce. We need him to make that dedication. We're not asking for new monies, although we understand he has an extra $11 million he may not know what to do with. What we're asking for is we're asking him to use existing city assets, existing city resources, meaning the city has a portfolio of properties. And all we're asking is that he make one small allocation to this vital workforce. So they're very concrete and very specific things that we need from our elected leaders. I want to emphasize the elected part, because we do vote. And you may say, well, our voting rates are not as high as those of the dominant community. That may be true. But these days, elections are being won by 100 votes, by 1,000 votes, by 10,000 votes. And these emerging communities have great resting power, and we need them not to exercise it.
Mm. Dr. Bahir Bhutti, we do have a few minutes left, but I didn't get a chance to ask you, though, about what other places maybe are doing a better job of serving perhaps the Iraqi communities there, and what does the Iraqi community need? What can our listeners, what can we do for you?
Well, first, I have to say there are more job opportunities, or used to be more job opportunities in some other states, regardless of the, let's say, of the situation. People, if they don't have the job, they will move to Portland. That's, again, a good part of it. But recently, there are more job opportunities. It's an entry job level, regardless of your professional qualification. But still, people are getting more jobs here. And I can say, I mean, in other parts, it depends on also the time. Like there is this, in Iraq, there is the Chaldean people, the Christians of large sect of Christians of Iraq. There is a large population in San Diego, in California, and I just got an email yesterday. The mayor of a city there, El Cajon, made some bad comments about this population, and they managed to force him to resign. So people are working, and we can have this kind of influence here as well, as Berto said, in Portland. What we need people to do is provide resources for us.
Right.
Help us get access to these resources too, so we can utilize them for ourselves.
All right, and that's it for our show. Thanks to our guest, Jime Dogo, Portland African Community Elder, IRCO Africa House, Chabi Kerala, Oregon Bhutanese Community Organization, Dr. Bahir Bhutti, Iraqi Society of Oregon, Alberto Moreno, Oregon Latino Health Coalition, and our dear friend, Polo Catalani, thank you so much for being here. More information at IRCO.org or interculturalorganizing.org. Special thanks to engineer Steve Nasser and Sky the Studio Dog. The show will be podcast on KBOO.FM, hopefully. Grab that link and share it with your friends and family. I'm Lisa Loving. Follow me on Twitter for more news and information about the topics we discuss on the show. Theme music by the March 4th Marching Band. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for Political Perspectives.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. It's just after 9 o'clock, and coming up this morning on KBOO, Political Perspectives, host Linda Olson Osterlund interviews Elliot Adams, former soldier and past president of National Veterans for Peace, about the Close Gitmo campaign and hunger strikes in solidarity with detainees. And then at 9:30, guest filmmaker Mark Kitchell talks about his film A Fierce Green Fire, The Battle for a Living Planet, an exploration of the environmental movement and grassroots activism spanning 50 years, from conservation to climate change. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre at 10:15 on Flashpoints, Fukushima at a critical moment, as pro-nuke scientists still call nuclear power the real answer to the future's clean energy needs. Also, the fight to keep Edward Snowden free in the face of his courageous act of whistleblowing on America's massive spy network. At 11 o'clock, the Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. And a big thank you to KBOO members for your generous support in our recent membership drive. It's still not too late to pledge. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. Here comes Political Perspectives. Stay tuned.